You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of June 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show:
what we're seeing today, both from Obama and the NATO ministers, is reassurances with the countries that, because of their history, feel particularly threatened by any aggression from Russia.
From Barack Obama in Poland to the future or otherwise of Spain's monarchy to the homecoming of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl and more. We'll review the day's top stories with John Everard and James Boyes here in the studio. Then we'll head to Nairobi to ask our correspondent Tristan McConnell about his recent visit to Somalia.
There's certainly no sign that an end to al-Shabaab is going to be, you know, a recipe for peace in Somalia, and that's going to be a worry going forward.
Later in the show, we'll have some highlights from recent Midori House sessions, and we'll also find out how not to get shot, robbed, or indeed killed when you're travelling. That's all coming up on Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, right now. Lots coming up in the next 60 minutes then, but before all that, Suzanne Chislett has the latest news.
Thank you, Andrew. NATO has welcomed President Obama's pledge to review its military presence in Europe following Russia's intervention in Ukraine. The American leader is in Poland, where he's announced plans to ask Congress to support a $1 billion increase in funding to boost troop rotations. Mr. Obama's visit comes as NATO defense ministers hold talks in Brussels to consider what longer-term steps need to be taken to bolster the alliance's eastern defenses. The British Defence Minister Philip Hammond says other member states will also have to look at their budgets.
We have to be clear, as our economies begin to grow again, what our priorities are. And I think we've been starkly reminded that we owe our freedom to a willingness to invest in defence, and we can't expect all of that investment to come from the United States.
Syrian state media is reporting that voting in the country's presidential elections has been extended to midnight local time to allow all those queuing to cast their ballots. There's been heavy criticism of the presidential election, which comes despite ongoing violence in the civil war. Bashar al-Assad faces rival candidates for the first time, but is widely expected to win another term in power. Only those in areas loyal to the government are being allowed to vote. Syrians in Brussels have demonstrated outside the European Parliament. George Chechan Haido is a spokesperson for the Syrian opposition in Brussels.
They are together here to ask the international community to take care and to keep its promises to the Syrian people, who asked mainly and firstly for democracy and for dignity.
The Pakistani city of Karachi is on lockdown after the leader of the MQM party that runs it was arrested in London. Altaf Hussain is being questioned about money laundering allegations. Despite his political affiliations, the 60-year-old has lived in the UK since 1991, insisting his life would be in danger if he returned home. In Karachi tonight, extra security has been deployed to the British High Commission. Shops and markets have closed, and there are reports of massive traffic jams as people try to get home amid fears of violence. Spokesman for the MQM party in London's confirmed Mr. Hussain has been arrested, but a senior party leader, Farooq Sattar in Karachi, denied that.
Arrest has not been made so far, and I think he is severely ill, and he needs hospitalization and he needs treatment.
Spanish politicians have set out the next steps in the abdication of King Juan Carlos. Following the monarch's announcement that he wants his son, Crown Prince Felipe, to follow him on the throne, there have been calls for a referendum on whether Spain should become a republic. Those have been dismissed by the Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, who insists the Spanish royals have the support of the great majority in the country. All necessary legal steps are expected to be completed by June 18th, with the royal household then deciding the date of the coronation. A senior German government official wants all property owners in the country to be legally required to have flood insurance. Florian Pronold, the Parliamentary State Secretary in the Environment Ministry, has told an industry conference that costs of covering such disasters must be spread. Last year, insurers paid out 1.8 billion euros on 140,000 damage claims following severe flooding in the south and east of Germany, 85% of which were in areas away from those designated as high risk. And the ban on YouTube in Turkey has been lifted a week after the country's top court ruled it was a breach of human rights. The video-sharing website was blocked in March ahead of local elections after recordings of top security officials were leaked. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, which is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Dr. James Boyes, political historian and visiting senior research fellow at King's College London. We'll start in Poland, which is currently hosting President Barack Obama, who is on a short European tour. The president has announced something called the European Reassurance Initiative, which in practice is $1 billion worth of military spending to reassure Europeans in that part of the continent that they're not going to be asked for directions by Russian army tank crews anytime soon. First, we'll hear what our Brussels correspondent Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson told us a bit earlier on the briefing.
What we're seeing today, both from Obama and the NATO ministers, is reassurances. It's reassurances for these countries along the eastern phalanx of the European Union. It's Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, the countries that, because of their history, feel particularly threatened by any attempts, any perceived aggression from Russia.
James Boyes, I'll start with you. $1 billion. It's a lot of money, but in terms of defence spending, it's magic beans, really. How much reassurance is this buying anybody?
Well, there's a track record of American presidents coming to Europe and basically offering largesse and solidarity. I mean, don't forget John F. Kennedy's famous speech in Berlin in 1963 was very, very similar, but without the financial backing. I think what you're seeing here is a speech by Barack Obama that has a number of audiences. Obviously, the Kremlin is number one, and I dare say that John will have a lot to say about that. But there's also a domestic constituency, don't forget. We're heading into an election season in the US. There's a lot of Eastern Europeans, for example, based around a lot of democratic strongholds in Chicago. There's also, I think, a degree to which this is an attempt to reposition US foreign policy. We've heard a lot about the Pacific pivot. This, I think, is basically saying, yes, fair enough, that's important, but there are long-term strategic implications in Europe which we need to keep an eye upon.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Kennedy speech, because I guess in some way this is quite indicative of what appears to have been Barack Obama's whole approach to foreign policy. Something, it's measured, it's possibly largely symbolic, it's gentle, it's certainly not, nicht bin ein Berliner, still less a Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Is it, I'll come to you now, John, is this likely to sort of, I mean, is it going to cost Vladimir Putin a second sleep, really?
Yes, I think it's going to cause Vladimir Putin quite a lot of sleep. Effectively, President Obama, in announcing the billion-dollar upgrade, if you like, of the NATO presence in Eastern Europe, has drawn a line. He's saying, you're messing around Ukraine, you're in deep trouble there, and we're watching, we're giggling slightly, but don't even think about touching any of our guys. You mentioned the billion-dollar. There's another very important component to what the United States has done. They have said that they are going to develop partnership with Georgia and with Moldova. Both countries, over which Russia thinks it has a kind of protectorate, both countries that are trying to get out from under. And America is essentially saying that if you mess around in Ukraine the way that you're doing, then we are also going to make sure that Georgia and Moldova stay on the side of the angels, don't think about going
Couldn't
there.
That get us into a fairly weird area, though, given that both Georgia and Moldova are not just under a certain amount of Russian sway? They actually have Russian troops on their territory, admittedly in breakaway regions, Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia and Transnistria in Moldova.
It gets us into some very murky territory. The territory gets murkier and murkier if, by partnership, Obama is signalling a route along which those two countries can actually join NATO. If they do join NATO, then all they have to do is to announce they appear to have foreign forces sitting on part of their territory, and NATO is obliged to go in and deal with the situation.
Well, that's a happy prospect. Thank you very much for raising that. James, how have NATO countries in general, especially those rather closer to Russia, Poland and the Baltic states especially, have they been hitherto reassured or otherwise by Barack Obama's response to the Ukraine crisis?
I think one of the problems you've got is that there is a recognition, I think, that this administration has really sort of dithered effectively about which way it's going to jump in terms of foreign policy. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is the fact that this administration has made no secret the fact that it wants to basically get out of foreign engagements and not get embroiled in engagements. This administration, after all, has got about, 2 years left in office. I don't think it wants to get involved militarily in this part of the world. This announcement today, as you rightly alluded to at the beginning of the show, is very much, it's not a tear down this wall. It's not an Ich bin ein Berliner speech. It's certainly something which, after all, don't forget, has got to get through Congress. The spending plans have got to get through the House, for example. The Republicans might not like it particularly. So the degree to which this is actually going to be implemented is still open to debate at this point, I think.
John, what's your view or otherwise of how well Barack Obama has handled Ukraine? I mean, it's a very weird thing for him to have been presented with, because on the one hand, he can argue, well, really, this has absolutely nothing to do with the United States. This just isn't our problem or our responsibility. And yet we still live in a world in which everybody expects that pretty much everything is America's responsibility.
That's right. I have to say that I personally think he's handled Ukraine really rather well, very cleverly. He didn't give Putin what he wanted, which is lots of heroes, a military conflict of any kind with any obvious anti-Russian nasties. He has tightened the economic noose around Russia, which is hurting now very badly. He's drawn red lines, and he's then sat back and allowed the Russians to go and hang themselves, which effectively is what they've done. As we speak, the Ukrainian army is launching a full-scale assault on the Russian separatist area of Slovyansk, which appears to be going the Ukrainian way. Vladimir Putin has got himself in a position where he's annexed Crimea, all right, but his attempts to meddle further in southeastern Ukraine, note the geography, we used to talk about eastern Ukraine, but Kharkiv has kept out of this, have gone very, very badly wrong. He's attempting to support a military movement that appears to be losing its battles, and worse, in Slav eyes, and particularly in the eyes of the pro-Russian nationalists who supported so vital to Putin, he has not actually sent in troops to support those people. A lot of people in Moscow and in southeastern Ukraine right now will be saying that Putin has betrayed them. Putin let them down.
I also wanted to solicit your expertise, John, on another thing that Barack Obama will be doing while he's here, which is, I think, if it's Tuesday now, yes, this must be Friday, he will be attending the 70th anniversary commemorations of D-Day at Normandy. Vladimir Putin has been invited to that. Speaking as a former diplomat, how awkward is it going to be if he does turn up?
I think it'd be rather fun, don't you?
We can hopefully look forward to that. They're always a treat, those photos of Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin together.
Smiling blissfully.
Yeah,
yes.
who really clearly...
Not necessarily really, each other, of course.
Really clearly cannot stand each other.
No doubt about it. And, you know, they might be smiling, but they'll be looking in opposite directions and dreadfully, desperately thinking, OK, when's the next photo up coming? But it will be interesting to see if he does show up indeed.
I mean, just a final thought on this subject, I guess, James. It is an interesting contrast between Poland and Ukraine, and it's amazing to think it was only 2 years ago they were joint hosts of the European Football Championships. Since independence, what has Poland done right that Ukraine hasn't?
Well, I think that ultimately, you know, you've got two very different peoples. You've got a very different relationship, I think, with Russia. I don't think anybody thinks that Russia wants to start getting involved in Poland, because we know how those sort of things transpire. But I think that ultimately you've got a very different relationship. Poland, of course, is a member of NATO, so therefore you've got security alliances. You've got a very different relationship with the West, I think, and certainly Ukraine would not feel, I think, that it's in the same boat as Poland. Again, you know, Article 5 under NATO has very, very serious ramifications for both the West and for Russia in this case.
Well, let's move on to Spain now, where the abdication of King Juan Carlos after nearly 40 years on the throne has prompted interesting numbers of people to hit the streets suggesting that they don't see any particular need for a successor. We've had tens of thousands of people across Spain demonstrating in favour of a referendum on the future of the monarchy. John, you were there, I believe, when Juan Carlos began.
I was there. That's right. I'm so old. I've actually worked in Spain under Franco. I used to have little conversations in dark places with Spaniards talking about the overthrow of the dictatorship. And for me, the whole thing is a tragic comedy. I mean, Juan Carlos, when he took over Spain from this decrepit dictatorship, showed real moral courage. I mean, to do what he did took guts.
Because I think it is often forgotten that we're just so accustomed to the idea that Europe is a bastion of liberal democracy, that people forget that that is a blip. That I mean, I'm like to think I'm not that old, but well within my lifetime, most of Europe have been dictatorships, Spain among them, and people forget that it's not necessarily a sure thing that there was a transition to democracy.
That's right, and it certainly was no plan of General Franco that Spain should transition to democracy, and his supporters were aghast at what the new king did. Remember, there was an attempt at a counter-coup, the Guardia Civil invading the Cortes, invading the Spanish Parliament, all kinds of shenanigans, and Juan Carlos, ice cool, right through it, stared them all down and said, no, this is the way it's going to be. We are now a constitutional monarchy.
So why has his popularity deserted him? There was a poll in El Mundo last year that suggested two-thirds of Spaniards said he should quit, he should go.
I think he made a lot of mistakes. Firstly, there's this really quite sleazy scandal surrounding his daughter, Princess Cristina, and her husband, who's taken, it is alleged, rather over 5 million euros of scarce Spanish public money. And of course, right now, public money in Spain is particularly scarce, for over-invoiced projects of one kind or another. And there's the famous and completely unpardonable elephant hunting episode in Botswana. I mean, shooting elephants is morally reprehensible in any case, politically suicidal, and to do that at a time when Spaniards were struggling to make ends meet was an absolutely crazy thing to go and do.
It does seem a fairly elementary PR gaffe,
yes.
As they go with that one. James Boyce, to come to you, would... And there's a couple of assumings here, but assuming there was a referendum held on the monarchy, and assuming the Spanish people decided it was, you know, now surplus to their requirements, would a Spanish republic be as successful at keeping Spain together?
Well, I'm glad you came to that, because I was sitting here making some notes, thinking this is the great problem. If you remove that, whatever Juan Carlos is guilty of, or his larger family are guilty of, if nothing else, as a sense of national unity, they have been very good at keeping the country together. The question, of course, is if you go down the road of a republic, are you going to end up advocating and promoting and assisting this idea of a separatist movement? So will the Basque region, for example, decide that it doesn't want to play ball anymore? You don't have to go very far into the centre of Barcelona, for example, to realise how strong the Catalan movement is there. You're absolutely right when you discussed this at the top of the story. You know, you're not going to go very, very far. If you start watching reruns of Fawlty Towers, for example, just to realise, you know, what was the excuse about why Manuel was in it? Oh, I'm sorry, he's from Barcelona. The idea that Spain was a backwater country. We've come so very, very far in the last 30 or 40 years that it would be a real tragedy if by removing the monarchy at this point, it ends up destroying this massive success story of modern Spain.
Absolutely. Can I just say I agree with everything that James has said. I think it's important, too, to distinguish between polls showing support or lack of it for Juan Carlos personally and polls on the monarchy, which suggest that the majority of Spaniards would be in favour of the monarchy just without Juan Carlos. And Prince Felipe is a very different person, young, modern, outgoing, very sociable. I think he'll make a very good king.
Well, on that thought, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with Andrew Muller and also John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, among other places, and Dr. James Boyce of King's College London. When we return, we will be discussing Qatar's increasingly catastrophic World Cup and a real-life episode of Homeland.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is John Everard, the former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Dr. James Boyes, political historian, now at King's College London. We turn now to the US, where, like everything else that ever happens, the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl after 5 years of captivity in Afghanistan has descended into partisan bickering. Republicans are claiming that the price paid, the release of 5 deeply unpleasant Guantanamo Bay detainees, may have been dangerously high. James Boyes, first of all, does the GOP have a case, or is this just the usual bickering and hair-pulling and shin-kicking that attends?
There's no doubt about it. This is becoming a political football. I think the White House have only got themselves to blame for this. They tried to present this as a classic story of getting an American GI back, as though it was a rerun of what happened with Scott Grady in the mid-90s that was made into that movie Behind Enemy Lines. Unfortunately, as you alluded to in your introductory piece, this is more like an episode of Homeland or Manchurian Candidate, quite frankly, because there's no doubt that there are serious questions. In fact, the Army in the United States has announced today it's going to be holding an inquiry into the circumstances that saw this individual leave his post, apparently unarmed. The idea that maybe Americans have already paid the ultimate price trying to rescue him. If you look at the PR exercise, you've seen America's president standing on stage with his chap's parents, at which they made some very interesting and rambling remarks. His father has been tweeting apparent support for the Taliban. The White House keeps dropping the ball. Again, you saw Susan Rice on the Sunday talk shows talking about this guy's distinguished service, not being able to answer questions about whether the administration broke the law in terms of releasing him. It's a PR nightmare again for the Obama administration.
We have seen reports, interviews in fact, with Bo Bergdahl's former colleagues who do not appear by and large to be likely to buy him a drink at the next regimental
Absolutely.
Reunion. They call him a deserter mm-hmm. and a traitor, and remind that at least 6 men died yep. On missions looking for him. John Everard, is James right? Is this a massive... I mean, it's understandable and quite desirable, of course, that you would want to bring your prisoner home, however bizarre or inexplicable the circumstances of his detention. But surely you should have a bit of a think before you get all tie a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree about this.
Well, yes, it's not straightforward at all, is it? It's not just desirable to bring soldiers back. It's part of the soldier's code of the United States Army. You will not abandon a fallen comrade, I think is the quote. But as James has said, this has become a political football. I have to say that, firstly, I agree that the White House has mishandled this very badly. And I simply don't understand why they didn't say that they had a deal with the Taliban to release, get this guy out in exchange for the 5 prisoners from Guantanamo, facing the Republicans then with the horrible question of whether they're going to block those releases and take the wrath of having effectively abandon American servicemen or not. He could so easily have simply passed the ball to the other side.
On the subject, though, of these 5 men who are being returned from Guantanamo Bay, there have also been suggestions that these men have probably not become huge fans of, you know, truth, justice and the American way during their years as guests at Guantanamo Bay, and that doing a deal of this sort may embolden future hostage takers. Would you agree that that's a danger?
Yes, that is a real danger. And the White House must have agonized over the eventual decision for a very long time. It's a danger that they'll embolden others. It's a danger also, of course, that they simply go back to their old ways. Just how solid are the Qatari guarantees that they're going to stay there? And what happens when they are eventually released by Qatar?
Well, Qatar has promised that they will stay in Qatar for a year. But again, that does seem like a weirdly leaky guarantee, as in presumably in Qatar, I mean, you know, they do have the internet and telephones.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've seen, of course, it's news in London right now, the leader of a major Pakistani party running politics from Edgware in London, in Karachi. What's to stop these guys simply running operations for the Taliban out of Qatar?
James Boyes, it is, as John pointed out, an excruciating decision for the White House to have had to make, but is it too high a price?
One of the great problems you've got is that it's going to become a political football going into the midterms and then 2016. The only person I think that's going to benefit from this in the short term might be Hillary, because of course the focus is going to move away from Benghazi. But I think the GOP have got a point here. It would seem that the American administration is more akin to trusting the Qatari government than it is Americans in Congress, which raises all sorts of problems, I think.
Well, Bergdahl's release, as John mentioned, was mediated by Qatar, although any good publicity they might have hoped to accrue has been rather obliterated by further suspicions that their acquisition of the 2022 World Cup might not have been altogether above board. I can't have been alone in this. As soon as this was announced, everybody I know roared with laughter. I don't think there was a single person in the world who was, you know, who would think, yeah, they're going to stage the World Cup in a tiny, broiling desert that has absolutely no local football culture whatsoever and yet does have bottomless sacks of cash. I'm sure nothing shonky went on here. Are we at all surprised by this, James?
Well, I've got to be honest. I think that when you look at both the bids that won, if you look at the Russian bid and the Qatari bid, you've got to raise your eyebrows a bit this. You know, how is the infrastructure going to work in either country? Certainly in Qatar. I mean, I was over there very, very recently, and it's remarkable how much they're throwing at the infrastructure there. But I mean, you know, who in their right minds wants to play football in the heat and the midday sun? They're already now talking at the very least about moving it to winter, which would completely disrupt the world football program around the world. I think there's going to be a real serious question about whether this is ever going to happen. What's fascinating, though, is that Michael Garcia, who's meant to be putting a report together about all this, has now announced, as I understand, that he's not going to look at this latest batch of reports that have come out over the weekend, which of course is going to keep the shadow of doubt hanging over the Qatari World Cup. If and when this report does come out, it's certainly in anybody's best interest, and certainly the Qatari government's best interest, I think, for this to come out to find out exactly what happened and figure out a way around this. Because unless that happens, the shadow of scandal and doubt is going to hang over this until the first kickoff, I think.
John Everard, is it just that, I mean, we've talked a lot in this particular program, indeed, about Qatar's increasing desire to be seen as a diplomatic player, to be seen as a real power, the kind of country that hosts major events, that involves itself in big diplomatic moments. Is this just overreach? Is this just a case of somebody deciding we can do anything, let's hold the World Cup, and nobody pointing out that this makes about as much sense as Belarus bidding for the America's Cup?
You mean you wouldn't want Belarus to be for the America's Cup? Well, discuss. Okay, no, but fine. I think, yes, there is a certain amount of overreach. It's very Qatari, of course, very ambitious, very much we want to be world power. Would they be able to host a good World Cup? I think they've got the cash for it. I'm sure that, as James pointed out, they'd pour whatever it took into infrastructure to make it work. The organisation, well, we'd have to see. I think, can I draw the camera back a bit? I think this isn't just a difficult time for Qatar. This is also a difficult time for the World Cup as a whole. We've got the World Cup in Brazil, we hope, about to kick off very soon, with stadiums that aren't quite ready and riots in the streets and favelas still being cleared. I mean, it leaves me wondering just how many countries are going to rush forward in future to say, yes, yes, we want to take upon ourselves all the trouble and all the potential scandal of hosting the World Cup.
Well, I think especially in the modern media environment, any sporting event, as Russia discovered as recently as the Sochi Games, it is a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, the world pays an awful lot of attention to you, and on the other hand, the world pays an awful lot of attention to you. Do you think James Boyes, Qatar might already be regretting this?
No. to be quite honest, I think that they only see an upside to this. Okay, the scandal thing is terrible, but I think that they're going to basically try and muscle through this. They're already spending a fortune on getting everything ready for that. There's a huge presence when you go over there. They're very excited about this. I think one of the problems, though, is, as John rightly referred to, this idea that the World Cup and FIFA are getting in a right mess, because the decisions about where to hold these events now aren't being basically made upon where is the best footballing interesting location. But it's all about it's about legacy. It's far more about the individual egos, I think, of the individuals who are running FIFA, and about how we can use this as a social development process. You know, South Africa is a classic example of that. You know, this is a country which could probably ill afford to get the World Cup. Same with Brazil, and yet here it is, we're doing it. You know, but there's nations around the world which have the infrastructure and the stadium in place today to be doing this. We're sitting in one, arguably, right now in Great Britain, who keep getting overlooked for this. We must ask why, and it's all to do, I think, with legacy and not to do with football.
Just finally, there's one very slight and silly story that we do need to discuss, and I was particularly interested in your input, John Everard, given your sort of long and distinguished diplomatic career. The US Embassy here in London is reportedly planning to install nap rooms for diplomats. Is that something of which you would have desired during your years in station in Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea?
Do you know, throughout my long and hard career, I never had access to a nap room. I mean, just read that article, I'm feeling so hard done by. Young diplomats today just don't know how easy they've got it.
On that thought, we will have to leave it there. John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Dr. James Boyes, visiting senior research fellow at King's College London. Thank you both, as ever, very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our man in Nairobi. We'll be learning how not to get shot, robbed, kidnapped or blown up while travelling overseas. And we'll talk music with Paul Noble. But ahead of all that, here is Suzanne Chislett with the headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. NATO has welcomed President Obama's pledge to review its military presence in Europe following Russia's intervention in Ukraine. The American leader is in Poland, where he's announced plans to ask Congress to support a $1 billion increase in funding to boost troop rotations. Mr. Obama's visit comes as NATO defense ministers hold talks in Brussels to consider what longer-term steps need to be taken to bolster the alliance's eastern defenses. Syrian state media is reporting that voting in the country's presidential elections has been extended to midnight local time to allow all those queuing to cast their ballots. There's been heavy criticism of the election, which comes despite ongoing violence in the civil war. The Pakistani city of Karachi remains on lockdown after the leader of the MQM party that runs it was arrested in London. Altaf Hussain, who lives in the UK, is being questioned about money laundering allegations. And Spanish politicians have set out the next steps in the abdication process of King Juan Carlos. It follows his announcement on Monday that he wants his son, Crown Prince Felipe, to follow him onto the throne. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. Welcome back to Midori House. It's 21:32 in Moscow, which makes it 18:32 in London and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we are heading to Nairobi, where earlier I spoke with Monocle's Tristan McConnell. I began by asking if there's much cause for optimism in Somalia at the moment.
It's very much a mixed picture in Somalia at the moment from what I saw on a recent visit. I went to an area called Lower Shabelle, which is really the breadbasket of Somalia on the banks of the Shabelle River. And this is a part of the country that was recently retaken from Al-Shabaab, who are the Islamic militants who've been occupying large parts of the country for a number of years now. And what I was looking at was how the situation is for people on the ground in the immediate aftermath of a military offensive. And the simple answer is that life had gotten a lot worse. There was very little food in the markets. Families had been separated. And there was almost no sign of any kind of government control to replace the control of the jihadists who'd been recently ousted. Now, part of this is down to al-Shabaab, who block roads in order to make life worse for civilians after they've been ejected from a town. But it's also a failing on the part of the government, who are simply incapable, or some may say unwilling, to sort of step up and provide the most basic things. So healthcare, schooling, government administration, and security for people. And so, you know, when I was speaking to ordinary folk down in a town called Koriole, they felt like life had gotten worse.
It sounds comparable to what I remember finding in Afghanistan a long time ago now, 10 and more years ago, that people were always, when I asked people about the iniquities of life under the Taliban, they would say, well, yeah, it's bad, but they provided a sense of order and accountability, which is better than having none. Did people feel the same way about al-Shabaab?
That's very much the impression that I was getting. I mean, part of the problem, and again, I think this could be some parallels with Afghanistan. Somalia is a clan-based society, and people use, particularly unscrupulous politicians and businessmen, use clan as a way of sort of shoring up their support. And what I found in Lower Shabelle was that the people there felt like the government, the army, were kind of clan colonizers coming in to try to occupy their land. They didn't really feel like this was so much a fight against al-Shabaab Islamic militants. They felt like it was a land grab by people in Mogadishu. And that, I think, is very worrying for the future, and made it quite clear to me that, you know, although al-Shabaab may be on the back foot, they're losing territory, and certainly they can't win a military battle against the arrayed African Union forces with their Western backers. There's certainly no sign that an end to al-Shabaab is going to be, you know, a recipe for peace in Somalia, and that's going to be a worry going forward.
You mentioned clan there. Isn't this what any attempt to bring about a sense of coherent order in Somalia is always going to run up against? That for many Somalis, clan trumps all other considerations and all other senses of identity?
Yeah, that certainly is an issue that they're grappling with and have been grappling with. You know, there's a move in Mogadishu and government to try and address this through a new federal constitution that would allow, you know, a degree of devolved power to the regions and therefore, you know, to different clans to sort of kind of share power. But, you know, that at the moment has become just another bone of contention, another source of conflict. And I do worry, from what I've seen on the ground there, that, you know, if al-Shabaab is pushed out, we're simply going to return to what we saw before, which is essentially a clan-based conflict over resources. So we see that battle in Mogadishu, where there's money to be made in the port of Kismayo, in Lower Shabelle, which is very fertile, like I said. And we see less conflict in areas where there is nothing worth fighting for. And this is a very worrying picture indeed.
Well, moving along from where you've just been to where you're about to go, you have a trip planned to South Sudan, which in many respects appears to be doing something of an impression of Somalia at its worst.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of a government failing to do even the basics for its people, that's the case. I mean, you could go even further and say, you know, many of the problems that South Sudan is facing right now, that is a broad and kind of spreading conflict, and now a looming kind of hunger crisis, which some fear could turn into a full-blown famine, is not just because of, you know, failings on the government part, but is in fact because of the government. This fight that began in December between the president and his former vice president is all about political power. And the result on the ground is over 1 million people forced from their homes, well over 10,000 people killed. And those, you know, that latter number could pale into insignificance if starvation takes hold. And on top of that, we've just in the last few days, aid agencies have noted a cholera outbreak in the capital, Juba. So things are simply getting worse and worse. And what is most striking about South Sudan is that it had so much international goodwill behind it at independence in 2011. And that's been squandered kind of wantonly by the political leaders there. And this crisis that the people are in the midst of now can be laid squarely, you know, at the feet of the country's political leaders.
And just finally, not so much about where you've been or where you're going, but where you are now, there have been gathering warnings to tourists planning to go to Kenya. We've seen stories of people being evacuated after various nations have issued travel alerts. What do you think? How does it look where you are? Is Kenya a safe place to visit or not?
I certainly feel like it's a safe place to live. If I didn't, I wouldn't be here. Look, there are these fairly regular now bombings and grenade attacks, and they are occasionally deadly, and that's obviously a worry. But the attacks so far have not really been in the kinds of places that tourists and foreigners are going. To scare tourists off from their Mombasa hotels, I think is a little over the top. I mean, what I'm noticing and what people I talk to are noticing, and this is, again, a worry now and going into the future, is that the terrorist threat a few years ago very much emanated from Somalia, from Al-Shabaab, but increasingly it's looking as if the terrorist threat is here in Kenya. It's at home, and that's a worrying thing for Kenya looking forward.
Is that terrorist threat an entirely domestically focused one, by which I mean is it various Kenyans attacking each other for very local reasons? Would there be anything to be gained by anybody there from making foreign tourists a target?
It's hard to see how anyone in Kenya can gain from that. I mean, jobs are lost, the economy suffers. The guys who are doing these attacks are... they're Islamic militants. They are linked to Al-Shabaab, but it doesn't look as if they're taking orders from Al-Shabaab in Somalia. They're doing this off their own back. And that's why the Kenyan establishment, the Kenyan government and Kenyan people are so worried, because it makes it that much harder to kind of find, who these people are, who is really doing this, when the enemy is kind of within, if you like, and can no longer, all these attacks can no longer really be blamed on, outside enemies.
And that was Tristan McConnell in Nairobi. Up next, we'll be meeting the author of a book you should probably read before going to visit him.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push, maybe, that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House, 1842 here in London. Now, our man in Nairobi before that break was just reassuring us that his hometown is a much safer place to visit than nervous foreign ministries, tour operators and travel insurers would had you believe. And indeed, very few slightly screwed up locales are ever quite as bad as they look on the news. But this is no reason to be blasé. A useful and portable addition to your rucksack is the Personal Security Pocketbook by Rupert Godison, who joins me now. Rupert, at what point should one heed the advice of your foreign ministry and clear off? Is there a particular kind of tipping point at which a country really has become unsafe to be in?
Well, that's interesting, Andrew, because I trained a team about 4 months ago, and they were going out to Libya to do a job out there. It was a small sort of like media operation, and they asked me the very same question, and I said to them, the thing to look at is to listen to your intuition, and when you start to feel uncomfortable, that is the time to go. And they gave me an example of they're in a hotel, and one of the team leader basically said to me, one day I woke up and I something just wasn't right. It wasn't right, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. So I sat down in the lobby, and all of a sudden I realised that there were no taxis coming to the front of the hotel at all. And I remember saying to them, if that happens, that's the time to go upstairs, grab your bags, which you've already had pre-packed, so it's not sort of all over the hotel room, and head for the airport, because it's much better to be at the airport feeling slightly silly than to be sort of stranded in your hotel. So.
Those indications, I guess they do that knack for spotting those things. It does take a while to acquire. I do remember once, about 2005, being in the back of a British Army Land Rover in Basra, which drove down one street and then abruptly stopped. Yeah. And the commanding officer said, "We're not driving down that street." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Nobody else is." It was a similar kind of thing. But this book that you've put together, which is obviously for people travelling in those hazardous places, and it is usefully portable, which is unusual in a travel guide, and very reassuring. But tell us a bit about yourself, first of all. Where have you acquired the wisdom that's contained in it?
Well, I've been a soldier for about 25 years. So I served in the TA for about 25 years. I've done three operational tours in Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. But after my third tour, I was approached by the company that trains the BBC, and they said, "Look, you've got a really interesting CV. You've got obviously a lot of military experience, but I've also travelled quite a bit. So they said, "Look, would you like a job as an instructor?" And initially, I said no, because I'd worked for the company before, and there was a very very quick turnover of instructors. And I said, "Well, no, I don't actually." And then they came back and said, "Well, would you like to maybe work for us on a part-time basis?" So I ended up running one course a month for about 6 years. And then I ran courses in Islamabad, in Delhi, in Kenya, in America. And then a friend of mine phoned me up and said, "Look," he works for a large media organization in London, and phoned me up and said, "Roo, we've got three photographers going out to Mexico City to take photographs of sort of drug deals in progress." And I said, "Look, well, you're never going to see them again, basically. So, so just don't send them over there." And then I also said to him, "Look, I think you should go back through all of your other sort of like files of people deployed around the world and have a serious look at it." And he sowed the seed in my head. And said, "Look, why don't you start your own company? You're a good instructor. You've got a very sort of affable style. So why don't you start your own company?" Which was why I then sort of started HASP training. And I'd already written a couple of other pocketbooks, mm-hmm. on a military theme, and I decided quite unconsciously to write down, in terms of a sort of like a lesson plan, like a living sort of document or lesson plan, all of the things which I had learned. So I read a sort of magazine, I think, "Well, that's quite useful." So I jot it down, and I had that penny drop moment all of a sudden where the book just literally popped into my head.
So in your experience of instructing people and preparing people to travel to places like the ones you'd served in, although obviously without the advantage of a uniform and a gun, what are the most common, I guess, misconceptions people have, or the most common, or one of the, or some of the more common mistakes they make once they get there?
I think probably they initially have that sort of rabbit in the headlights moment when they actually get to the airport, because they've maybe thought about the trip, thought about the hotel, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're 1 minute they're in Terminal 5 in Heathrow with their sort of pink Samsonite suitcase and the sort of jumbo pink corduroy trousers, not really giving much thought to what they look like in the other end. And then all of a sudden, the arrivals door parts and they have that rabbit in the headlights moment. And a lot of them fail, well, not fail, but don't really prepare correctly. So they don't have much of a sort of business continuity sort of plan. And I always advise them to scan all their documents in, all their important documents, make copies, and even email them to themselves, or even have them on a memory stick around their neck. That way, if you do lose all your stuff and you turn up to the British embassy, it's not going to be like Daniel Craig turning up to the embassy and all of a sudden they go, "Welcome in, Mr. Bond." You're going to be seen as a problem for them. And if you can show them that you've taken credible steps to help yourself, then I'm sure they'll be much more willing to help you, and your transition will be very smooth. And all this,
do you think that the risks to people, especially journalists, who obviously you advise a lot travelling in those types of places, have changed? I mean, last week we had the great and veteran foreign correspondent P.J. O'Rourke in here for an interview, and he was talking about how when he used to do that in the 70s and 80s, it was actually kind of your get out of jail free card. You just sort of put your hand up and go, I'm a foreign correspondent from the West, and at which point the crowds would part and you'd be delivered to safety. Whereas now, that can often have the opposite effect.
Absolutely. And I ran some training for a production company that went to Ecuador, and they were concentrating solely on living in the jungle. And it was at the time that Julian Assange, well, obviously he's still there, but Julian Assange was all over the papers, and Rafael Correa was getting quite cross about the Brits and all this sort of stuff and the Malvinas, etc. So there was three big things. And I said, look, it might not be a great idea to overtly advertise that you are British, you know, British caps and sort of, you know, British sort of like T-shirts, etc., etc. So just you don't need to sort of flaunt that, you know, when you get there.
I've been grateful in similar circumstances for my Australian passport on more than one occasion. We will have to leave it there. Rupert Godison of HASP Training and author of The Personal Security Pocketbook, available now. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Our music review is next. And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now to take a look at the best and occasionally the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre and the arts in general. Today we are talking music, and we are talking it with Monocle's Paul Noble, who joins me now in the studio. Paul, welcome to the programme.
Thank you. It's very bright in here.
It is, but our listeners can't see that.
No, this is one of your calling cards. Turning it up and turning the aircon down.
I prefer to be able to see who I'm talking to. Right. We're talking today about our own, the sessions we record here, the Midori House sessions.
Exactly.
In fact.
Yeah. I mean, I know you've got an audience of news lovers and political affairs hounds, but we also have a weekly culture show presented by Rob Bound, where we put live sessions on pretty much every week. Four tracks. We'll invite a band in to play either in our performance space or in one of our studios, and we've had, well, I mean, must be getting on to over 100 bands of, you know, big names. Up-and-coming names, artists on the jazzy side of things, on the electronic side of things. So I thought I'd pick out a few today just to introduce people who may not know about the sessions. And they're all roughly in the sort of Americana theme. So let's start off with the band who played here recently, Lake Street Dive. It's one of those names it took me ages to remember. It's sort of three words.
They could be in any order, couldn't they?
Yeah. And then as soon as I saw them, I was like, okay, Lake Street Dive, I've got it. These are four jazzers. They're from Boston. They met at the New England Conservatory of Music. So they can play like anything. They came to fame with a cover of the Jackson 5 on YouTube, which didn't do much for me, but it seemed to get tons of hits. And then they released this album of fantastic, very Motown-y inspired music. So this is a track called 17.
That was Dive Lake Street. that was Lake Street Dive there with 17, the first Midori House session chosen by Monocle's Paul Noble this afternoon. They often are quite surreal and peculiar experiences, the sessions.
Well, I mean, these are bands who are in the middle of their tour. They're either playing that night somewhere in London or they're doing the promo, you know, whirlwind dropping into the BBC and all the other news organisations. And suddenly they come into Monocle. You get a lovely cup of tea. Everyone's very presentable. It's the middle of the day.
Well, most of us are very presentable.
Yeah. Everyone else is presentable. And then suddenly you're playing in front of, you know, a very intimate audience, 30 people right in front of you. And it's, I can imagine it's very strange for a lot of these bands who are either used to just being them in the studio or on stage where there's something of a remove and suddenly they're in Monocle land.
Weirdly, they all seem to enjoy it, though, although some of them have been memorably peculiar. I still think having Steve Earle playing in our cafeteria is one of the oddest things I've ever seen, and I've seen some stuff.
Yeah. No, he was something of a fish out of water. Yeah.
But anyway, moving along, who's your next selection?
Next one is the Pierces, who are Alison and Catherine. They're from Birmingham, Alabama, not up the road. And they've, I think it was Catherine had been in before with James Levy. And
yes, she had. I remember doing that interview.
Yeah. So she originally, so they've played together for a while. It's all coming together for them now. They, in 2012, they supported Coldplay on their North American tour, which seems to have sort of nudged them further into the public conscience. And they did a very lovely unplugged set for us. The track, which is in sort of heavy rotation on some of the albums, on some of the radio stations at the moment, is a much more electronic and produced version of that. But I think it's safe to say everyone fell in love with them. They're two gorgeous girls and, you know, the whole room seemed quite smitten by them. So this is a track called Kings.
The Pierces with Kings, the second Midori House session chosen by our guest Monocle's producer, Paul Noble. Who's next?
Next is Nick Waterhouse. I brought him up usually because we usually reach out to people, as they would say in America. And Nick actually came to us. He's a fan of Monocle. His manager got in touch and said, I see you've launched a radio station. Nick's touring through London. I hadn't heard of him. He's on Stone's Throw Records from California, and he's very into that 60s R&B classic sound. He's got a great look, a big pair of Buddy Holly specs. And this is a track called High Tiding. Oh, come closer. And if we got to the end of that track, which we don't have time to, you'll hear lots of whooping. And that's one of our sort of end of the day sessions, which are a bit more fun. There's usually some beers and some white wine involved. And that's a very different dynamic to the lunchtime dragging everyone down.
We should mention that all those Midori House sessions can be found on our website at monocle.com/24. Just look for the Culture Show with Rob Bound and you'll be able to scroll through them. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests John Everard and James Boyce at the top, and Rupert Godison and just now Paul Noble. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Joel Church. Next up, after the headlines, we'll have our weekly design show, Section D. Then at 2200, the Monocle Daily with me and Nancy Durham. This show returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.
London.
Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.